like now to introduce Ed Steer, about whom you've heard a great deal, and I really can't add much to it except to point out that Ed's had a really almost unique experience on the front line, in that he's been on the front line with the powers of the federal government and on the front line of an effort to try and develop and implement an internal program in the Teamsters Union to try and root out corruption, which is a very unusual situation. Ed?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jim, Herman. It's really a pleasure to be here this morning. I came here because I wanted to see who would show up on a Saturday morning voluntarily to hear discussion about labor corruption. Jim and Herman said some very flattering things about me, and I really appreciate it. But you all know that Herman has been at this for decades longer than I have, and will be here doing it decades after I'm on to something else. And Jim has been an extraordinary catalyst in the government and academic community to try to stimulate some analysis of how all of this power and all these resources have been used for so many years, to see if we can learn some lessons and to direct those resources in the future in a more effective way. Which leads me to a sort of a broad observation of this. For anybody who has the naive idea that the government knows what it's doing in the field of cultural reform, all you have to do is look at Iraq, because exactly the mistakes that are being made today in Iraq by our government were made in connection with the efforts to bring about cultural reform in the labor movement. Because when you talk about removing the influence of organized crime and creating an opportunity for members to exercise democratic rights in the framework of their unions, you're really talking about cultural reform, deep cultural change that has to come about. And what I want to do this morning is to talk a little bit about what it takes. I was very fortunate in the sense that I stumbled through a process of transformation at Local 560, and we had, I think, a good result. But I don't want anybody to think that despite what I like to say about how all this was planned and how the strategy was devised ahead of time, I don't want anybody to think that that's the truth. The truth of it is that we fought for many, many years, sometimes not knowing where we were headed, sometimes believing that there was no hope of success. And we kept on fighting until we began to see daylight and then finally put a plan together to reach our goal. But I can remember meeting with the then U.S. attorney in New Jersey and saying to him, as was Mike Chertoff, who's now the head of the Department of Homeland Security, saying to him, what if we're not successful? What if we can't remove the racketeer element from this union? What do we do? So let me go back a little bit in time and kind of walk you through the history of Local 560 and my efforts to change the culture of that union. I'm going to focus on Local 560, but when we get to the question and answer session, if anybody has any questions about my experience at the international level, where I tried to work within the union without any government support to bring about a similar cultural change and to create the capacity within the union itself to deal with organized crime and corruption. If anybody wants to talk about that, I'm happy to answer any questions about it. But I think that Local 560 is really a microcosm that gives us all the information we need to understand what it takes to bring about cultural reform in a thoroughly corrupt environment. I think the starting point was the kidnapping and murder of Jimmy Hoffa. Internally, I was in government, I was in law enforcement at the time. Most of my career, up to the point where I became involved with Local 560, most of my career had been spent in federal and state law enforcement positions, specifically dealing with organized crime and corruption matters in New Jersey. All of you know that New Jersey is the major leagues of organized crime and corruption, so I had a pretty good sense of what I would have to deal with when I finally got to Local 560. But during the late 70s or 80s, when Hoffa was kidnapped and murdered, it shook federal law enforcement. Because although most of us viewed Hoffa as a corrupt labor leader, fact is that he was a very dynamic, very important figure in the labor movement, a national figure, who at the time ran a union whose membership was something like 2.5 million people. Very important figure. And when the government recognized that organized crime had reached a level in this country where they would take on and remove, kill somebody of that stature, it shocked the federal government. The FBI immediately started investigating it and focused on Local 560 as the source of the crime, as the place where the crime was hatched and where most of the people who participated in the murder came from. Chief among them was, of course, Tony Provenzano, who was a leader of one of the largest locals in the country. Maybe at one time it was the largest local. It had about 15,000 members in Local 560. He was also an international vice president and someone who himself had gained prominence nationally as somebody who could knock on the door of congressmen and even at the White House. And yet, Tony Provenzano was a prominent member of the mafia. When I say member, I'm talking about, I mean, you all watch The Sopranos. He was sworn in, took an oath of allegiance to the mafia, and he was thoroughly allied with organized crime. He was not a labor leader who happened to be corrupt. He was a mafia figure who happened to control a union. For reasons that you've all probably read about, he took on the responsibility for kidnapping and murdering Hoffa. So the federal government focused on him in Local 560. Now, he had already been prosecuted and convicted in connection with labor racketeering. In fact, when I first went into the federal government, one of the first cases that I found in my file drawer that I inherited from my predecessor was a case against Tony Provenzano, an extortion case. And he had been just convicted on another case, was sent to prison. I was there the day that he went off to prison. Courtroom was filled with reporters and observers and a lot of excitement because he was an important guy. I had heard rumblings that there were some dissidents in Local 560 who had run against Tony Provenzano had, in fact, won an election, but, of course, it was snatched away from them through a variety of schemes operated by Provenzano, stuffing ballot boxes, intimidating members, phonying up the vote count. I mean, there were all sorts of ways of doing it. They came to the federal government for help back in 1965, it fell on deaf ears. The government just simply didn't do anything for these guys, and they were sort of brushed aside. And from that point on, despite the fact that Provenzano served prison sentence, he was firmly in control of the union. Not only did you have Tony Provenzano, but you had his brothers Salvatore and Nunzio, who, when one or the other was in prison, would alternate leadership positions in the union. And they had a whole cadre of racketeers, Salvatore and Gabriel Bergoglio and Mike Sciarra, and I can go on and on. The Andretta brothers were racketeers who had roles within the union as business agents, trustees, some shop stewards, but in key positions. And so Provenzano had this very tightly established infrastructure within the union. So despite the fact that the federal government would prosecute and convict Tony Provenzano or one of his brothers or somebody else, Provenzano was able to maintain control within the union. And to give you an idea of what it was like there, the leader of this dissident group who had run for president, a very popular guy by the name of George Phillips, one of the most courageous human beings I've ever encountered, at one point was beaten in a truck terminal behind a truck with ball peen hammers, and his skull was fractured. He, of course, was taken to the hospital, almost died. Within a very short time, he crawled out of his hospital bed and came to a membership meeting and confronted the Provenzanos. And when he walked in that room, everybody got up on their feet and applauded. Even Provenzano's supporters couldn't resist responding to the courage that George Phillips showed. So in spite of the fact that you had a George Phillips in the union who was willing to face that kind of terror, in spite of that, Provenzano was able to maintain control. And eventually he wore them down and got them, pushed them out of the union, deprived them of work opportunities, because that's the primary mechanism that racketeers will use when they get control of a union. It's economic pressure drove them out of the union. And there were a lot of things that the Provenzanos did in controlling the union which were detrimental to the union itself, but designed to assure that new, young, independent workers wouldn't come into the union at a rate that they couldn't monitor, that they couldn't control, so that they couldn't inculcate these new young members with the values of the community that they had created. Very important that everybody who came into the union and remained in the union understood that the word of the leadership was the law, that it was forbidden to ask any questions that might embarrass anybody in a leadership position, that in order to work, in spite of what your contract said, and in most cases you had no idea what your contract said because you never saw a copy of it, in spite of your rights, you kept your mouth shut if you wanted to work. And if you played ball and did favors for your shop steward or your business agent, work your way up, you could ultimately become a shop steward or maybe even go further in the union. But you had to be totally loyal. If the sun was out and Tony Provenzano said it's raining, it was raining. You put up your umbrella. Let me tell you one very quick anecdote, give you an idea of what it was like in those days. When I finally took over as a trustee, we had a strike against a freight company, and it was a very, very tough strike. Finally, the company went out of business, and the shop steward on that job, who'd been in the union for quite a while, seemed like a very decent guy, showed up on the picket line every day and worked with us to try to salvage as much as we could out of the job. I helped him get a job in construction once the freight company folded. One day he was up at the union hall, and there was a demonstration outside, demonstration. Scara had been the president of the union, removed by the judge. Just the two of us up in the union hall, and I pulled him aside and I said, "You're a smart guy. You obviously care about your the members of the union. I said, listen to that crap he's spewing outside. I saw you were out there cheering for him. How can you buy this stuff? I said, look, what you do politically is up to you, but I just want to know. I want to get in your head and understand what your thinking is." He said, "I'll tell you a story. So when I was a young kid, I was working at a freight job over here. I lived in New York, lived down in the village, and I got a job, was working in a freight company. One day the business agent came over, was having a meeting, and I said, I got a question for you. When are you going to straighten out my pay? The company's holding back money. They shouldn't be holding it back. I've asked the shop steward for it. When are you going to take care of me?" The business agent didn't say a word. Just went on about his business. And he said, I finally shut up. And the next day, I was at a lot where I dropped off my truck and was getting in my car. I opened the door of the truck to get my jacket, and I heard a voice say, "Hey, Bobby." I turned around, didn't see anybody. And I heard it again. And I looked under a trailer, and I saw three pair of legs. And he said, "I didn't even closed the door. I didn't take my coat. I just ran." He said, "I ran all the way across the George Washington Bridge. And I finally made my way back home to the village. And I said to my father, I'm in trouble. Obviously, I did something wrong." And my father said, "Come with me." And they went down the street into a candy store. In the back of the store, there was a guy sitting behind a table. And he said, "Tell him your story." He said, "I told him my story," and the guy said, "Well, kid, you're going to get a beating." And I said, "I didn't even know there was a mafia in New Jersey." And the guy thought that was very funny. And he said, "All right, kid, I'll straighten it out." And he said, "I went to the union hall, and I had to swear in front of all the business agents that I'd never open my mouth again. I kissed the business agent who I had insulted by asking a question about my pay." And he said, "The business agent was Sally Berguglio, who was one of the people who participated in the killing of Jimmy Hoffa." And he said, "The guy in the candy store was Chin Gigante, who, as I'm sure all of you know, was the head, until very recently, of the Genovese family here in New York." So you see the direct connection between a guy in a candy store in New York and the Union Hall over in Union City. He said, "And from that day on, I haven't opened my mouth." So those kinds of incidents, those kinds of stories, create the climate of compliance in the union that the racketeers rely on. The government decided that enough was enough with Local 560, and a very tough prosecutor by the name of Bob Stewart actually, over the objection of the Department of Justice, filed a civil RICO suit for the first time against a labor union. He sued Local 560, 1982. The judge who happened to get that case was Harold Ackerman, who had been a labor lawyer in his younger days and had a feel for the labor movement. So you've got a tough, relentless prosecutor and a judge who has some empathy for the plight of the members of the union. And the case was tried. Very, very important. Wasn't settled. Wasn't compromised. The case went to trial and ended up with a decision that everybody in this room should read at some point. I don't have the citation on the top of my head, but it's a description of the most horrifying conditions you can imagine by Judge Ackerman, who truly felt for the membership of Local 560. Case took years to wend its way through the appellate courts, and finally in 1986, a trusteeship was imposed. I was not the first trustee. First trustee was a man by the name of Joel Jacobson, who came out of the labor movement and whose approach to carrying out the objectives of the trusteeship, his approach was to run the union the way a union should be run, and he believed that the membership would recognize what they had been deprived of all these years when they saw how a union should be run and would rally behind him, would rise up, just like the folks in Iraq rose up and welcomed us when we rolled into Baghdad. Equally naive. After 10 months, it was clear that Jacobson had been compromised by the racketeer element because, you see, their tactics are not just using fear, not just, you know, threatening to shoot and physically harm people, but their most important weapon is seduction. I mean, fear doesn't get you where you need to go if you're a racketeer unless you're very effective at seducing those in positions of power whom you ultimately want to control. And they were able to seduce Jacobson into believing that they were okay. These guys were just misunderstood labor leaders, and that he would teach them how to run the union. Then he could turn the union over to them, and they would run it properly. Or maybe he'd be elected president of Local 560. Both of his assumptions were extraordinarily naive. And the judge finally decided he had to get Jacobson out of there, and he decided to replace him with somebody a bit more confrontational and somebody who understood organized crime, and he asked me if I would do it. I had a strategy. I won't begin to describe it to you, but I figured I could get the whole job done in a year and a half. No problem. You heard before, I was the trustee for 12 years, and I continue to be the chairman of the benefit funds at the request of the union. I no longer have any official government authority, but the union has asked me to stay on as the chairman of funds just in case racketeers re-infiltrate the union. They want to make sure that their pensions are going to get paid and that their benefit funds aren't stolen. So I still have a very deep connection with Local 560, and I still maintain contacts within the law enforcement community so that I have a sense of what the racketeering environment is like in which Local 560 operates, because one point that Jim made is extremely important for all of us to understand. Racketeering doesn't originate in the union itself. That is, organized crime doesn't originate in the unions themselves. It comes from the community and infiltrates the union and takes advantage of the power and the resources that unions have. But if it's not present in the community, if it's under control in the community, it's a lot easier to get it under control in the union. And when it's out of control in the community, as it is in a place like Chicago today, it has a very heavy presence in labor unions. So it's important that we understand the overall organized crime picture of a community. I had the most power, I think, of any trustee, or certainly as much power as any trustee has ever had in a union. I ran the union. There was no executive board. I was given the authority to negotiate contracts, process grievances, ran a number of strikes, dealt with wildcat strikes. I mean, I handled the full range of problems that labor leaders handle. I'm by no means suggesting I'm a labor leader, but I did have some immersion into the world of labor leadership. I took the job on condition that somebody would come in with me who really did have an understanding of labor had to run a labor union, and an extraordinary man by the name of Frank Jackowitz, who had been the principal officer of a Teamsters local in New Jersey, but a completely honest guy, came in with me, and he and I functioned as brothers. That's the only way I can describe it. I didn't delegate responsibility for him to run the union side. I wanted to do it. I felt it was important that the trustee do the things that labor leader had to do, but he guided me. He understood. And the one thing he taught me that was the most important lesson in all of this is that no change can come about in the union unless it comes from within the membership. And he said that to me many times. I didn't completely understand it when he first described it to me, but he was absolutely right. Unless the membership want change, unless you ignite, as a trustee, some kind of a spark within the membership, nothing is going to change. The values, the culture will not change, and corruption will reemerge and be tolerated as soon as the pressure is off. My objectives were, one, to run the union as effectively as I could for the benefit of the members, because that was the first priority, and that was the issue when I first came in. It was a tremendous opposition to trusteeships from within the labor movement, from honest people, as Herman mentioned, who feared that government taking over a union would destroy it as an effective collective bargaining tool. So I felt my first priority was to keep the union running. Secondly, to remove the racketeer element from within the union. Absolutely critical. You cannot achieve cultural reform while there is an infrastructure of corruption existing within the union. You've got to remove it. And that, of course, is another lesson that we haven't learned when you take a look at Iraq. And finally, and most difficult of all, once you're running the union properly and you've removed the corrupt infrastructure, you've got to try to create a democratic environment. And what I mean by that is an environment in which honest leadership can begin to emerge and gain the trust, confidence of the membership so that they can establish themselves and create their own political infrastructure and continue to run the union in an effective way. That's what took the 12 years, that last piece of it. We had effectively removed the most prominent racketeer element within 3 or 4 years, but the rest of the time was devoted to creating an environment in which new leadership could arise. Let me tell you very quickly what some of the problems were, and I think that this deserves a lot of discussion and analysis. There's a dilemma that you face as a government imposed trustee in the union. And the dilemma is that the more aggressive you are, the more you focus yourself as a catalyst for change, the more self-defeating it is. Because however benign you think you are, however loyal you believe you are to the interests of the members, anybody from the government in a labor union is going to be viewed as a transplant that needs to be rejected. And I think rightly so. The labor movement should not be dependent on government officials moving in and running unions. So there's a natural sense within the union that if you're the government guy, we want you out of here. As nice a guy as you seem to be, we want you gone. And even the most honest, committed members of Local 560 felt uncomfortable having me there. So the more I do, the more I become visible, the more I become a rallying point for those who want to get me out for good and bad reasons. Secondly, the more I do, the more it costs. And that then becomes an issue for the union. Unions should not be called upon to empty their treasuries for the sake of supporting a trustee. And from a political standpoint, it's a great argument for those who want to get rid of the trustee. Hey, these guys are taking your dues money and squandering it. In addition to that, the new leadership is, by definition, going to be inexperienced and not have a political infrastructure of support. We had an election after 2 years in 560. The racketeer, it was a very democratic election. The racketeer element won the election. We did a very detailed survey afterward to find out how that could have happened, and we've learned a lot about how trade unionists think. And the what I learned from that was that even though I think organized crime in the union is the worst thing that could possibly happen, and that's my first priority is to get it out of the union, a guy on a freight job, his first priority is get the boss off his back. That's what he cares about. And if there's a guy that he thinks has enough experience and is tough enough to keep his boss off his back, that's the guy he's going to support. He's not going to support some guy that he thinks may be more honest but hasn't demonstrated the capability to get him what he wants on that job. Very important lesson for us. And so over the course of those 12 years, I had to move myself into the background as much as possible. I stopped attending membership meetings. I tried to fade into the distance as much as I could. And I created a process, even though we didn't have elections all during those years, because you couldn't trust the racketeer element not to rig the outcome necessarily, but create an undemocratic environment in which they'd be sure to win. But I had to create a process by which, through a process of attrition, as I removed racketeer-related officials from the union, new leadership would take over first as business agents and then work their way up into the executive board and finally gain enough confidence of the membership so that they could run for office. And I will never forget, we used to videotape the membership meetings. I'll never forget watching one membership meeting at which one of Mike Sciarra's, actually he's related to him, but a very loyal guy, started taking on the guy who had become the president of the union. It sort of worked his way up through the chairs, and honest guy who was now the president of the local. And they got into a fight, not a physical fight, but a verbal battle at this membership meeting in which the president of the union referred to Sciarra as a racketeer, said he destroyed this local union, he stole from the union, he's rightfully thrown out of the union, and for the first time, probably in the history of Local 560, membership began to applaud. First slowly, and then finally it was clear that the message had gotten across, that they trusted the new leadership, that they were willing to accept publicly something that they all understood privately, and that is that their union had been exploited for generations by these guys, and they were now willing to openly support new leadership. At that moment, I knew that I could see daylight, and that would only be a matter of time before elections demonstrated that the membership had accepted the new leadership, and that as soon as we reached that point, I told the judge, it's time to bring this to an end. It was an extraordinary experience for all of us. Changed my life, certainly. And as I said to you at the outset, I still am deeply committed to Local 560 and its members, in spite of the fact that I no longer have any official role. I just wish that the federal government would sit down and extract from my experience and from the experience of many others a real understanding of what it takes, because the government officials that I talk to on a regular basis have a very, very superficial understanding of all of this, and there is no formula. And maybe people like Jim and Herman, who've been beating the drum for years about the importance of establishing connections between union members who want to see their unions cleaned up and government officials who have the power to help. Maybe with continuing pressure from organizations like AUD and with books like the one that Jim wrote, and all of the continuing stream of very pointed articles that Herman writes, maybe someday it'll happen. If I can contribute to it, I'm only too happy to. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Ed, for a fascinating recounting of what happened in Local 560 from an unusual vantage point. Does anybody have any questions concerning this? You, sir.
Ed, I have a question. Gene Carroll from Cornell University. What role did providing information to the members about how their contracts were substandard under the racketeering regime compared to others that weren't, the decline in the value of their pension, their health and safety record on the job, those kinds of bread and butter things that people really care about, and you were able to begin to get that information out, how important was that in getting people to open their eyes?
Surprisingly, it had surprisingly little effect until something happened that was like breaking a dam. We put out a lot of information about substandard contracts. In fact, when I got there, I started a newspaper, 560 Free Press, which annoyed the racketeers terribly. And in fact, the woman who was our editor was subjected to some terrible pressures. A very courageous young woman. But a lot of information was pumped out, seemed to have no effect whatsoever. Until 10 years after I got there, we raised pensions significantly. And the reason we were able to raise those pensions was because when we got there, we reinvested all the money, took it out of the hands of corrupt investment managers, and indexed it, which is, you know, the safest way to invest it, but probably gives you the lowest return, but it was done honestly. And as a result of the success of those investments, we were able to significantly raise pensions. When we raised pensions, the membership, there was a wave of anger that went through the union, not directed at me, but directed at the past leadership, because they realized, finally, how much money had been lost during all of those years, that the money had been squandered. Somehow, when the reality of it set in, as a result of raising the pensions, it began to turn things around, and they began to recognize and talk about how poorly they had been represented all of those years. But it was 10 years before there was even a hint that the membership recognized how they had been exploited.
Let me just say one thing about that very short.
All right.
Short,
Before you do, I'd like to ask those who wish to, who have questions that need to come to the mic. Ken Nash of Building Bridges has reminded me. And also the speakers here have to speak into the mic. Herman.
Very quick. It's a very, very important question. I'm just want to address, I think that Carl Beers will, I'm hoping, will address himself to exactly that thing which has been a critical element in an ILA trusteeship. So if Carl is here, I hope he's heard the question. Okay, and I think he'll address himself to that when he speaks. Okay.
Any other questions, sir?
Yeah, Gabe Gabrielski, Atlantic City. I have a question. Maybe it's too big for you, but I just want to throw it out anyway.
Nothing's too big for us.
I think it's maybe what sociologists call a counterfactual. I'm interested in what you think makes a union unattractive to organized crime. I spent my entire life in New Jersey, and you talk about community, that's not sufficient, because I happen to know that there are a lot of local unions and even whole districts in New Jersey that may be conservative and have a lot of other problems, but they're not infiltrated by organized crime. What is it that makes a particular kind of union attractive to organized crime and another type of union unattractive to organized crime?
That's a very, very complicated question. There are certain industries that are highly susceptible to corruption, exploitation, and there are industries in which outside the union, there's a presence of organized crime. One example, and I've seen this, you know, New York, New Jersey, Chicago, is the construction industry. Construction unions, because you don't have members that remain on a single job over long, long periods of time and have, you know, seniority on those jobs because they're so dependent on the union for referrals. Those construction is particularly susceptible to organized crime. On the other hand, take local unions that operate in an industry where you don't have a presence of organized crime, and you probably aren't going to have organized crime in the local. For example, the brewery industry. Frank Jackowitz, who's the fellow I told you about before who came into Local 560 with me, had been the principal officer of Local 843, which was the brewery local in New Jersey, within a couple of miles of Local 560 and other corrupt Teamster unions. He was a completely honest guy. He didn't have a clue what organized crime was about when he came in with me. I learned about unions. He learned about organized crime. It's because the industry didn't have a presence of organized crime in it. So I think you need to look at the nature of the local. If there are many, many contracts, lots of low-wage contracts, in many cases it's susceptible to organized crime exploitation. Again, if they're, for example, school bus drivers. So there are a lot of factors, and of course, in some cases, you get lucky, and there's very strong, honest leadership who are vigilant and don't let organized crime get a foothold. So,
I just want to add just one tiny thing here. Is it there are a lot of different unions that have been penetrated and influenced by organized crime. Many we know about and some we don't know about. But even unions like in the movie industry and a lot of places where you would think, gee, how did organized crime get in there? And one wonders whether there isn't just some fortuity about that. You know, somebody knows someone or, you know, somebody is asked to do something in some place and the infiltration begins.
Herman, do you wish to say something?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a big sociological question about where is organized crime most comfortable. But I think that at least one of the factors that I think is critical, and that is wherever workers do not have real job security, and where the jobs are transient and dependent upon some bureaucrat, that is where organized crime comes in. Because they are able, what you really have in most of the cases is collusion between, let's say, unscrupulous bosses and corrupt union officials who, with their joint control over jobs, the employers do not want job security for workers because of their employers, and the racketeers don't want job security for workers because they want to control the jobs. So wherever you have sort of a transient situation, and workers are really nervous about their jobs, that's one of the places where organized crime comes in, and that's why in construction industry, where jobs are all transient and there's no seniority provisions at all, organized crime is particularly prevalent.
Sir?
Thank you, gentlemen. My name is Pete DeNuzzo. I'm from Mason Tenders District Council here in New York City, Labor's Local 79. It was interesting that you had said something about Michael Chernoff earlier, that you had asked him that question, what happens if we fail? I'd like to know that answer, number one, and I want to get into something further because Michael Chernoff and I, we've had differences on how he handled what ultimately became a supervision after the consent decree. And it was almost like, here we go again. And I thought that, you know, people say the government. Well, you know, like you said before, actually your lawyers from law firms that had worked with the government before. And to us, it was a cash cow because basically it left doors open for the situation to happen again, which we did. We went right back into the same situation. And with the independent hearing officer, Peter Vira, I was there. And I ultimately had got up at that meeting and said, I'd rather have Ed Steer come in. Let's get it over with. And he says, well, I know Ed helped me up in Buffalo and stuff like that. And I says, well, what are you waiting for? You're naming a vice president of the Eastern Region to come in here as a supervisor. He's been rubbing elbows with the same people for years. What do you think he's going to do? We're setting ourselves up for more failure down the road. And this is something that, you just can't comprehend. And your average member out there understands this. And they almost like, they throw their hands up in the air. So, I really thought that Michael Chernoff did a horrible job because he replaced people that he shouldn't have replaced them with, ultimately to be, a lot of these people had to resign. Someone went to jail just 2 years ago. Okay?
Let's have Ed's comment.
And I want to know your answer with Michael Chernoff in the beginning because, I appreciate you. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Well, the punchline of the conversation that I had with Mike Chertoff, and we didn't reach any firm conclusions, but the punchline was that we could not permit that local to be returned to control of organized crime, that we might have to go back to the judge and say to the judge that you've got to break up the local and distribute the contracts to other Teamsters locals, but there's no way that we could end this trusteeship and simply hand the keys back to racketeers. And that was our tentative conclusion. Let me say something about the laborers' trusteeship. I think it's not a trusteeship. It's some arrangement between the laborers' international and the federal government. Most of you are probably familiar with it. I think that they've done in many cases a lot of very good work, and I know a lot of the people who, a lot of the investigators, I know Pete Vira and so forth, and, they've cleaned up a lot. However, I've argued for years that there is one flaw in that arrangement that may doom it to failure over the long term, and that is that there is no real connection between the membership of the union and the mechanism that's been created to investigate and prosecute corruption within the union. The investigators are all ex-FBI agents who do a very, very good job. You got hearing officers like Pete Vira, who comes from outside the union. The only connection between that system and the membership is way up at the top, of the International. And so no, there's been no systematic effort to root the values of that trusteeship within the membership of the union, and eventually the people who are doing such an effective job are going to be replaced, and they'll inevitably be replaced by people who are less effective. And I worry about the long-term effectiveness of that strategy. And I've argued with the Department of Justice for years, and it's one of the underlying principles that I tried to bring to the effort that we made at the International, which is you've got to have a balance between external independence and professional resources and union membership, who have to learn to understand and accept the fact that there is a new day within the union and that leadership is going to be held accountable to appropriate standards of conduct. Very difficult thing to achieve, and my failure at the International is International Brotherhood of Teamsters is a pretty good example of how difficult it is to do it. But the federal government's got to come to understand that.
Thank you. My name is Mike Sullivan from the Roofers Union in Philadelphia. We had a trustee down there, didn't work out too well. The question I want to ask you is, was there an IRS audit done with the benefit funds in 560? Because we had an audit done and it was a sham. Because I know for a fact that they were laundering money out of our health and welfare fund and taking it to a check cashing agency and cashing checks. And nothing was ever
No, there was no IRS audit. There was no audit by anybody other than us when we took over. And it took years and years and years for us to find all the ways that money was being stolen out of the benefit funds. It's very interesting because Provenzano had been under government scrutiny for years, and he was very sophisticated in the way he operated the benefit funds. He didn't cut an artery and bleed money out of the funds in an obvious way. They cut little capillaries, and small amounts of money would trickle out from a variety of sources. But when he collected it all at the bottom, same, you know, there's a tremendous amount of money coming out of the benefit funds. So we had to literally scour the records of the benefit funds to find non-existent pensioners who were receiving checks, to find out where management fees and commissions paid to the investment managers was actually going, would go through two or three hands and ultimately end up in the pockets of racketeers. To check out each of the service providers to the funds to see what they were doing in return for the money that they were being paid. And gradually, over time, we were able to stop the bleeding. But it wasn't easy. And one of the things that I worry about a lot is what's going to happen throughout the labor movement to weak benefit funds that have been bled for such a long period of time as we go through this horrible period of poor investment results and extraordinary inflation in the healthcare industry. Funds are going to collapse all over the place, and many of them have been weakened by exploitation for years.
If a member would bring that to your attention, that there was something going on with the benefit funds, that an external audit was done, you wouldn't fire that order, would you, if he found something like
that? I don't think so.
You're going to speak this afternoon, and I imagine you're going to tell us what happened in your local. Did you have a question or a comment, Michael?
I'm Michael Goldberg from Widener Law School. I have a question for both Jim and Ed. About the cost of these trusteeships or the interventions in there. They cost a fortune, and as far as I know, most of the cost has been borne by the unions, which were already victimized by the influence of organized crime, which is why the government is there. and it gives tremendous political ammunition to the old guard who are trying to get these remedies out, saying, well, you're bleeding the treasury. What is the answer? Where should the money come from, and is it realistic to think it could come from somewhere else, and I guess, you know, meaning the government as opposed to coming out of the union treasury?
Well, this idea of getting organizations that have generated, let's say, a lot of corruption to police themselves and entering into settlement agreements so that they will put into place systems and hire people and do things to prevent further exploitation. This is a very good strategy from the standpoint of the of law enforcement, because it allows law enforcement to leverage itself, you know, across a lot of different cases. You know, you think about the KPMG case, you know, and who's going to monitor KPMG? Who's going to pay for that? It would be a wholly different situation, you know, if that had to come out of the budget of the Department of Justice, you know, and from their perspective, they, you know, every nickel is precious. They're pressed to the wall in their assignments of people and getting resources. I don't think, you know, that could happen, you know, under any kind of political environment that I can imagine. So I don't see any alternative to the locals paying for it, other than maybe making the internationals, maybe there could be some kind of sharing there. The answer that some of the trustees will give is that if we do our job right, we can reclaim a lot of money, we can save a lot of money. You know, you can't just see it as a one-year investment. This is an investment in a healthier local. It'll attract more people, we'll do better organizing, and in the end, it'll be more successful. I think there's a lot to that. I think that the vulnerability of these trusteeships to criticism that they are being milked by private sector lawyers who are getting extraordinary amounts of money from these cases and billing their associates and so forth, I think that is a serious problem. And there ought to be a way in which the fees can be capped, and that we can still attract capable people. And I think that that ought to be done, and that ought to be a concern of the Justice Department, ought to be a concern of the judges.
Look, I think that despite the fact that the costs are very high, it's still worth it. But I think the problem really is in part a simple one. The monitors who come in are either accustomed to making too much money, or they'd like to become accustomed to it. And their rate per hour is just too high, that's all. I mean, you know, but nevertheless, even though it's overpriced, like a lot of things in life, you've got to pay for it, and I guess it's something that is worthwhile in the end.
Just let me make a comment. I don't know how it got this way, because you're right, and many of these trusteeships are extraordinarily, unnecessarily expensive. I was fortunate in that, I had a firm, and I literally left the firm, but I still had the firm generating income for me, and my rates that I charged Local 560 were very low in comparison to my rates. And when I got there, I said to Frank Jakowitz, we need a union newspaper here. Now it's going to cost about $20,000 a year for it. I make sure that we pay for it. He said, oh, a membership isn't going to pay for that. I said, well, who's going to pay for it? He said, take it out of your pay. So I literally reduced my my compensation to pay for the newspaper, and that was Frank's attitude. He wouldn't take a postage stamp.
Hey, how would you like to come and work?
So my I don't want to sound like I'm tooting my own horn, but from a practical standpoint, I viewed this as I viewed it as self-defeating to charge extraordinary amounts of money for my services. I tried to keep my fees to roughly the level that the union lawyer was being paid. And I remember talking to another trustee, I won't tell you who it is, but somebody who was about to go into a situation similar to mine, and he said, well, how does it work? I said, well, two things. One is you have got to get to know the membership. You've got to be out there, out in the on the jobs, getting to know people if you're going to understand the union and understand how to structure the trusteeship. And secondly, don't view this as a moneymaker, because you're not going to make any money at this because it's self-defeating. And I won't tell you who it was, but just exactly the opposite happened. And it really troubled me, that these things have gotten out of control. I blame it on the judges who haven't effectively controlled the trustees and monitors, and the prosecutors who've just walked away from these things and said, well, our job is done now that there's a trustee in there. From the very first day until the last day that I left Local 560, Judge Ackerman and the prosecutor who was responsible for that case and I were a team. And I can tell you that if they thought that my fees were high, they would put a stop to it.
I want to take one last question before we break for lunch. We're resuming at 1:15, and we'd like to start promptly at that time with Carl Beer's presentation about how you involve the membership. So is there another question? And I want to remind everybody there will be a question session extended at the end. Sir.
Yes.
Go ahead. You're on.
Yes. My name is Mario Pierre. I'm from the Grassroots Haiti Solidarity Committee and also from the Bataille Ouvriers Solidarity Network in New York.
From where? I'm sorry, we didn't hear.
The Grassroots Haiti Solidarity Committee and also from the Bataille Ouvriers Solidarity Network.
Okay, go ahead.
In New York. This is a very unique situation where the ouster of the organized crimes here in New York City came from government-appointed people. It's very unique. I support union democracy based on workers' organizations, workers organize, and workers' initiatives, really. But I could understand that this was a very unique situation. Isn't it a reflection of the failure of the left here in this country that organized crimes was not wiped out early, in the 70s, earlier in the 60s, 70s, 80s? Isn't it really a failure of the left here in New York City? And also for Mr. Spear, I think the information that you brought to us is very important. Are you thinking of writing a book or some articles, whatever, so that this information can be, articulated to other to workers throughout New York and the United States and throughout the world, maybe. And I also want to thank the Association for Union Democracy for organizing this event today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as far as the book is concerned, read Jim Jacobs' book and Herman's articles. There's very little left.
Herman's got a great book.
Right. Here we go.
Herman's got a great
Here's Herman's book. There's very little left for me to say beyond that. We did write, by the way. I don't know how many people have it. We have part of what we did at the IBT was to write a history of organized crime in the Teamsters Union. It's a 625-page book. I thought it was pretty good. And it describes a lot about my experiences in Local 560, along with a very broad history of organized crime nationally and how it's how it infiltrated the Teamsters Union. Failure of the left. You know, it's a failure of everybody that organized crime reached the proportions that it did. On the left, it was, in part a distrust of government, feeling, I guess, that government is pretty much dominated by big business, and the people on the right, a sense of alienation, and a failure to recognize the threat that organized crime represents to the institutions that the left was so concerned about, like the labor movement. Even to this day, if you talk to many honest, sincere, liberal folks who are interested in organized labor and protecting the working men and women, organized crime is way down on the list of problems that they think about, and there's a sense that somehow by creating labor institutions that that are strong and effective, that they'll somehow overwhelm the threat of organized crime and corruption. I can assure you that that is an extraordinarily naive view. The AFL-CIO has ignored this problem pretty much throughout its history. And as a result of it, racketeering has corroded the labor movement to a very significant degree. And all of us have paid a terrible price for that.
What's the role of QAC?
I'd like to break for lunch. You can raise the question in the afternoon session. I'll hold on to it, or perhaps address Ed afterwards. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the speakers. It's been a stimulating session.